This is Jack LaFleur. For thousands of years, indigenous peoples of diverse traditional lineages have inhabited the greater watershed of the Columbia and Snake River system. As we've listened to these people speak on earlier programs, their legends and folk tales have reflected their spiritual ties with other species, all of whom are members of the biotic community within this ecosystem. Undoubtedly, their forebears learned a great deal by observing their fellow species, and little by little, a collective body of lore was assembled, which was shared by many indigenous humans who may have spoken no common language or dialect. However, fishing, hunting, and gathering were common to everyone, as was an enduring sense of affinity with Mother Earth, upon whose good health they relied for sustenance, both physical and spiritual. Their environment provided for them, and through ingenuity and perseverance, they developed skills for gathering and preparing foods, constructing shelter, and fashioning artifacts. On our program, we'll listen to Indian people who live in the bioregion of the Columbia Plateau describe the ways of life of their ancestors, ways of life that over the passage of time were proven to be in balance with the flow of nature. We'll hear from Alan Pinkham, who acts as liaison between the Nez Perce tribe and the National Forest Service, and Horace Axtell and Miley Lawyer, both of whom are highly venerated Nez Perce elders. We'll also hear from Ed Edmo, Pat Courtney Gould, Sophie George, and Sharon Dick, who are Indian people of different tribal bloodlines who have lived their lives along the Columbia River. Their generation was the last to spend childhood at Celilo Falls, a traditional center for salmon fishing and intertribal trading, which was visited by indigenous peoples for at least 12,000 years. On March 10, 1957, Celilo Falls was inundated when the United States Army Corps of Engineers closed the floodgates on their newly constructed dam, thus flooding this ancient site, which resulted in cultural impoverishment for thousands of Indian people who have honored the spirit of place.
Where I actually kind of grew up was not too far from here. It's on the other side of the Bonneville Dam. Because after the dam was put in, after Celilo was flooded and the Dalles Dam was put in, and then they had sites where they placed the Indians where they could be while they were fishing, and then when they were done fishing, they went back to the reservations. When we'd be in the mountains, when I say along the Columbia River, we can gather our roots, we can gather our berries. Where we're at there at Wind River, Washington, we go not over 30 miles where we pick our huckleberries and our wild strawberries and blackberries and there's various types of berries, like the choke cherries.
When we talk about Mother Earth, we're talking about us receiving nourishment from Mother Earth, not the other way around. To utilize Mother Earth for our benefit, we should be taking care of Mother Earth, making the water pure so she can survive and not dig into the rocks for minerals and destroy, you know, her skin, or cut the trees. It's like cutting her hair. All we need to do is start to understand that why we are here and how we're connected to Mother Earth. What we call the blood for Mother Earth is the Clearwater River, is the Snake River, is the Columbia River. Because if you look in your veins of your body, you'll see how it flows and goes into branches. Well, it's the same thing with Mother Earth. Those rivers and streams are like arteries and supplies blood for her life and the things that she provides for us.
Seafood is a large portion of our diet. The sturgeon, the salmon, the catfish, whitefish. I mean, you don't have to like all of them, but they never like to throw anything away.
I remember in the springtime of the year when my uncles and my dad fished, they'd bring fish up to the house and we'd carry fish up. When I was 9, 10, 12, 13 years old, we used to carry sacks of fish up to the house. And to my grandmother and my aunts and my mother and them, they all cut the fish. and they'd put it in drying sheds and put them in salt and dry them, cut them real thin in layers and dry them, put newspapers in pieces so it wouldn't get stuck together, and put them on racks and dry them. And I remember when I was a little kid, my job was to chase the flies away, so I had newspaper, I'd always go in there. I was chasing the flies all the time. And I always got the first taste of raw fish to the finished product. I was always eating on fish. The springtime of the year we did that, and just before fall time, when the season was closed, they couldn't sell it. So that's when they brought it up and they dried it, canned it, with the salted it. They set it in salt water. And we had salted salmon, dried salmon, and canned salmon. They'd bring 20, 30 sacks of fish up. Some of those sacks, man, we could only hold two fish, though, too. When you're carrying them sacks, some of them were dragging the ground when I was bringing them up. And it was kind of a going thing is who could carry the most fish or who could carry the most fish in the sack all the way home without stopping.
You catch a salmon, you clean the salmon, and you leave it for like about 8 to 10 hours. You hang it up. You let all the blood and the water come out. Then you fillet it off the backbone. Every part of the salmon basically is used for food, except the insides. You hang it on dowels. The red salmon you do in the shade, the red meat, and you hang it up on poles and you get it to where it starts to dehydrate. It gets its stiff texture. Then you hang it up on preferably cedar sticks. Cedar is a natural insect repellent. And then you just let the wind dry it. All you put on it is salt. You let the wind dry it. That's the red salmon, the red meat fish. But in the fall time, when you dry the tule stock, then you fillet the fish and you have big racks outside in the sun. You fillet those fish and you lay it out in the sun until it gets a stiff texture. Then you move it into a smokehouse. You have smoke going on it. It stays in there like a week. Alderwood is the best wood. Some of the people used to use oak, white oak, down in the Underwood Village, but my sister and I found that white oak is too strong. It makes good smoke, but it's really strong, and it tends to make the fish taste bitter. Alder's the best.
They had to pick certain woods because there's certain woods that would give it a bitter flavor. For instance, like cottonwood wood. And they'd try to get like willow or alder. They never used pine. That was one of the first things the women did as soon as they got their camp established while the men were hunting, is to get the wood for smoking. Well, just like Archie Lawyer told them when he was trying to get the captive Nez Perces back from Indian territory, he said they were used to eating their fish and their deer meat and elk meat and their roots. That was their basic diet because they got the salmon from the river. My father always told me when he was a little boy, of course he had no father or no uncles or anything there, but there were two men that always took him out in a canoe, and they'd go out at night and they built a fire at one end of the canoe and he had to watch it, and the fish would come up, they'd see the fire and they'd come up to the edge of the water and they spear them. And they do that in the winter time to get the white fish. He said they were bony. And then they'd fish for the salmon and suckers and what trout, whatever they could get, where they would do that. And then they always went for their venison and their elk. And nearly everybody went up the mountains to hunt. And the women went along and they cut and they dried their meat to eat. Then in the springtime, well, it began about June, the women began to dig. And they have these diggers, and they dig them up and get them ready, and they dry them. And it's pure carbohydrate. It's just like potato. They have one that they call kaus-kaus. They have another one they call kakit. It's similar to the other one, but it tastes a little bit different. And they have the bitter root. And then they have a wild carrot that is crisp and white inside with the light brown color, but it's sweet and nice. And they dry those. And that's for their winter. And then in the fall, like now, they're up to Weipe digging camas. And they bake that in a pit and build a fire and put the bear grass over it and wet it and put their roots in it, cover it up. And for 3 days, they keep a fire on it. Then they opened them up, and the roots are black. And it made the Lewis and Clark expedition sick. They all got stomach ache from eating those.
We used to travel from Ferdinand clear down to South Idaho. Grandmother had friends down there she'd go see every year that save her deer hides. And she'd take these buckskin gloves and moccasins that she made. She'd make a bunch of them, then take them down and trade them for deer hides again. And they'd save her a lot of other things besides. They'd trade canned fruit and things that way. We'd come back with a whole bunch of things. But every year it was like that. And same way in the fall when she prepared for the winter. We used to raise wheat on that little piece of ground we had. And then when they'd harvest our wheat, she'd go in and have 12 sacks set aside for flour. We never had run short of flour all winter. We had a storage shed. She put it away and covered up with canvas and keep it free from the mice and everything. I think that all comes from the way the old people used to migrate. Just like I was talking before, the first route that comes in the spring is on the hillsides up here. And that first one is like the leader. So when the first one is harvested, we have a feast. And whatever we have left over from the winter, we put in with that first food, like different roots that we have, and different fish meat, like deer meat, elk meat, moose meat, game animal. And berries, like huckleberries and sarvest berries and choke cherries. And we have a feast of all these traditional foods. And so that gives us a new life for a year until the first root comes again. So during our lifetime, if one should die in between the year, the cycle year, so when that person is getting ready to go to the good place, we have a feast with all these same foods, like a farewell feast. So that's how much respect we have for Mother Earth. We say we go back to Mother Earth to become dust. We put ourselves in the ground to recycle all these good things. So the newborn will have these things. But like I say, it's getting awful hard to gather some of these sacred foods now. But it's something that we still pray for. After the beginning of the new year, we start praying for the new foods to come every year. Sing songs and pray.
When a person dies in your family, your father, mother, your brother, sister, the old-timers used to cut their hair, cut their braids off. They still do. My brother cut his braids off since my father died. From the time he dies, you can attend, but you can't participate in the powwows for a year. And after a year, you have a giveaway dinner. And after the giveaway dinner, then it's called a memorial. And after the memorial, then you're eligible to dance. And back home, they have what's called Sundance. You probably heard of the Sundance back around Fort Hall, Wyoming. It's a different type of dance. And it's what they call a dance of thirst. It's a healing dance, what it really is. When you dance one dance, you owe another dance. Now, say my father went there last year and danced, and he died, then the oldest son would have to dance for him because he owed a dance. So my older brother, Buster, he would have had to dance for my father. Or if he wasn't able to, I'd have to dance. They still do that at the Fort Hall Reservation. They Sundance every year. They usually have two Sundances a year at Fort Hall.
Ever since I grew up, ever since I was a little boy, they always called it a sweat house. There's a name for that. The word for it is Wistitamo. Our way to sweat is not like a ceremony. Other tribes, it's different. They have their own ways. But I still tell my young people, we have our ways too. And a lot of these people are going out and maybe think it's neat to sing songs in the sweat house or pray or do all these other things. As long as I remember, we never did these things. It wasn't a ceremony. We have our religion, a longhouse, the place to go worship. That's one category, spirituality. So then we have games, play games, that's like stick game. And then we have our war dances, and we have our serenades, we have our under sweat house, all separate. We don't combine it all together like a lot of tribes do. So I try to tell my young people, we don't have to go out and do things the other tribes do. Maybe these guys might think it's neat. I said, yeah, it may be. But we're Nez Perce. Our people didn't do things that way. So the sweat house that I remember, the way I do it yet, the sweat house is, we call him the old man. Nez Perces call him a kiun, means old man. He's like a medicine man, he's like a healer, he's got wisdom, and he's got all the knowledge of the old ways. So when we go in there, we talk to this old man. We don't talk to the creator, that's somebody else, that's different. We don't use them kind of prayers, and we don't even pray, we just talk to them, thank him for allowing us to clean our body, strengthen our soul with the medicine that he has in the rocks and the water. So it's a little different, but when it's ordinary, it's not a ceremony. Still, our young people are going out and doing these things, and they're going out and to the sun dances, and they're doing a lot of things other tribes do. But I told them, well, if you're going to do that, you do it good. We don't want to be bringing stuff home and using it when we really don't know what it means. Of course, at least we know what our traditions and culture mean. That's the way I put it across. I've seen guys come to our old sweat house with a broken heart, like a man who had lost his wife. She died. You're very lonely. Come to sweat with us for a whole week, and he got healed. Never did sing songs or anything or pray in there. He just come to the old man and ask for help. First three or four times we went in the sweat house, he just quiet. He wouldn't say anything. He'd come out and he'd sit by himself out there and go back in. At the last 2 days, he started beginning to talk, beginning to laugh, beginning to tell stories inside the sweat house. The old man helped him. So that's the kind of things that I've seen in my life, and I guess maybe it's a little different to the young people now. I teach my sons how to do this the way I do it. But that's one of the things that I know is our way. And each family had their own place, own sweat house, and it was always welcome. So when we left some place, we go and have a sweat, and then tell the old man we're going to leave for a while. So he's like there taking care of the whole house, everything. So when we come back, we go to the old man and thank him for taking care of everything while we was gone. That's how important he was. He was, he still is.
My father said that a long time ago, they would make lean-tos out of branches and shrubs. Gradually, they used the tules from the edge of the water. They'd pull those out and dry them, and then they lace them together with sinew, and maybe they'll make them about 6 or 7 feet long. And then they put them around the poles to make a tule teepee. My dad said my first home was a tule teepee. And I said, did it leak? And he said, no, if it rained or snowed, those reeds would swell up and it would be waterproof.
The other thing characteristic of the Wasco people were bowls that they carved, wooden bowls. And we also steamed sheep horn to use as spoons. And then not only did we shape them and steam them for the spoons, but we also carved them. And all of those skills were lost. The basketry was also lost. When I grew up, I didn't know any Wasco Indian who wove baskets. And my family didn't even have the traditional Wasco baskets. I only saw them in museums. We did have the Klickitat baskets,
We have Chief Lawyer's spoon. It's made out of mountain sheep horn. And we have his wife's. It's a smaller one. And we have Chief Timothy's. That's a little bit smaller than Chief Lawyer's, but they're made out of the horn of an animal. And I asked Dad, how did they do it? And he said, His grandmother told him they boil it. They boil the horn till it's soft, and then they cut it and shape it. And we have those, and we have three spoons. They made bowls out of wood. This Tony Earl that lives down below Asotin come up on some that were so high like this, and they were burnt out in the center, and those were used for cooking. And then they had baskets, and they put the hot rocks in them to cook if they were going to cook.
Well, the thing I think in my boyhood was love of horses. I used to ride a horse every day. My grandmother had some horses, but we used to use them for pulling the wagon. And I done a lot of things with the wagon and the horse. Haul wood, haul a lot of stuff, plow the field. It took a long time to work with horses and traveled with horses.
I used to hunt up the Yakima Reservation, and my grandfather was Yakima. He worked as a guard at the Yakima Guard Station at the reservation. And when he was in the summertime working up there, I used to stay with him in the summertime. And I used to be able to hunt with him. We'd go up there and hunt in the evening and stuff. And it was a lot of fun. We used to go up there and hunt, and mostly for deer and elk early, just before fall, we'd get an elk. But deer, we mostly hunt deer. And I think I was 13 years old when I first shot my first deer. I was 13, and my grandfather gave me the gun that I shot with, a 32 Winchester Special. And I had that for years. Yeah, lever action, looked like a 30-30, same kind of frame.
Are you familiar with the parfleche? Well, that's what they used. My dad said that his grandmother kept one for dry meat. It had grease on it and everything, and she'd wipe it out and clean it and put it in the sun and get it ready because they were going to go hunting, because she would dry the meat up there and pack it very carefully because you had to keep it good because it's got to last you all winter. That's what they ate. And then they had the boxes. And I can remember my South Dakota grandmother having these boxes of the rawhide with the painted stuff on them under her bed, you know, one for socks and one for underwear and one for different things and on the other side for her husband because they didn't have bureau drawers or they didn't have anything. And that's what they used. And my brother and I looked in books and everything about how you dry meat. And I lived one whole summer down to Celilo because we had to take census. They were trying to decide what they were going to do with Celilo, whether it would go to Warm Springs or Yakima or Umatilla or whoever. So I counted Indians that come there, and I knew how many come from the Nez Perce and how many come from every tribe, and I kept track that whole summer. And I thought, well, I'm going to learn how from these women. And I learned how to clean a salmon and cut it up, and you get it out so far, and you put sticks in it. And they put it on the racks, you know. So my brother and I thought, well, we're going to do it because we own land up there where we could kill deer every night. We'd see the deer. So we did it. I got a teepee from Crow, and it turned out good. And then they made a pemmican, and these Indians did it too. They pounded up their meat, you know, with their mortar and pestle, pounded it real fine, and then they put either huckleberries or dried choke cherries or the dried June berries. They call it sarvas berries, any kind of dried berries that had a little sweetening to it. And then they used the fat from the animal that generally is around the kidneys. They'd render it out, and they'd mix it in while it was melted. And then they either made cakes out of it or they just kept it loose. And if they were going to travel, they made cakes, you know, about the size of a hamburger. And then they just take their flint knife and cut it off, and they would eat it like that. And it's good. So my South Dakota grandmother introduced us to that, and we just thought it was just wonderful. We're going to make some. And they use the back strip right under the spine. You know, it's part of a rib steak, the ribeye. He said, how many? I said, well, try three. So he went out and killed three deer, and it took us time to get it ready and everything. And so I cut them, and we dried them 3 days and three nights. He took care of the nights, and I took care of the days. And we pounded it up just real good. His wife helped us. We went to the slaughterhouse, and I got the fat that I wanted and rendered it out and strained it and fixed it. And we put the dried currants from the grocery store in it because I didn't have any, and little sugar. And, you know, we ate it up in one night. All that work. But He said, shall I go get three more? We had fun doing that.
And then we have another, it's similar to the sweat, but it's called a mud bath. It's more of a healing, like for arthritis or skin disease or, well, I was told this, that the old people used to prepare themselves for war this way, make themselves strong. They use a little bit bigger rocks, and they heat them the same way, but only they build it right close to the creek, dig a hole about the size of a sweat house, and they run this water into that hole, or you can sit down in there in the water and have the water this deep. And the water, of course, the water gets muddy. You heat these rocks, and then you have a pit that you dug. Then you dig a little deeper hole for the rocks to fall into. You push them all over into that one side. And you sit in there, and the water gets pretty hot. And you sit in there just like a hot spring. You come out and wash off like you do at the sweat house. Only thing is, you do this early in the morning, just about daybreak. I hear guys talk about that now. I used to go as a mud bath. We used to do it for a whole week, and I just kind of shake my head. And a man can stand it for a whole week. 3 days, you're drained out pretty good. It makes you weak, but then you can rebuild your strength real fast. You're unafraid. Your courage is built up. And there's a name for that too. They call it Tamayan Wes. All this Mother Earth cures you. You're getting from Mother Earth all this healing, cleansing. And I've done that.
In the beginning, we did have to go through court to win back Hunnigan fishing rights, which we had been doing since the late 1950s to the present. But now it's gone into other issues like gathering and grazing. Because gathering, you know, we used to dig roots, camas roots, cows roots, and other medicinal herbs out in the mountains where these forest lands are now. And so now it's because the impacts upon the resources, you know, the habitats and the water quality and those kinds of things, I'm very concerned about the conservation ethic of some of these resources. You know, we need to make sure that we take care of these resources, and they're on public lands. The Forest Service doesn't know a lot of these resources that we utilize. They probably know about the major ones like camas and cows and, you know, cedar bark and some of those things, but overall, I think they need to understand there's other resources that were utilized in these lands.
Featured on this episode of The Spirit of Place have been Alan Pinkham, Horace Axtell, Miley Lawyer, Ed Edmo, Sharon Dick, Pat Courtney Gold, Sophie George, and voices of other species who are members of the greater biotic community within the watershed of the Columbia and Snake Rivers. This 13-part radio series was produced for the Western States Arts Federation in association with KUNM-FM Albuquerque by Jack Leffler and Elaine Thatcher. Funding for this series was provided by the Ruth Mott Fund, the New Mexico Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Utney Reader Magazine, offering thought-provoking points of view on culture and society from over 2,000 media sources. Please visit Utney Reader on the World Wide Web at utney.com. That's www.utne.com. This is Jack Leffler inviting you to remain attuned to the spirit of place. Thank you for listening.